Today I will speak in English. I don't know if the rest of the week I will do that, but we'll see every day. I think I say this at the beginning of every retreat. I really don't like the first day, especially the Dharma talk the first day. I'm telling you my preferences. It's not so much, maybe it's not so much that I don't like it, it's that it involves changing and plunging into the unknown, and that is always always involves some resistance, and the first words are like that. The first I experience the same thing with writing, traveling. I've just returned from a trip, and it was like that, going and returning. It's an experience that I recognize, and I think we all can recognize that in different aspects of our lives and to different degrees in different circumstances. And an image kept coming back to me today that refers to that. And it was just a phrase that when I was at the beach, I don't know, my husband did parapente, you know, where he did this, I forget what we call it, is it parasailing, we say in English maybe? And the monitor said to him when he was like, you know, 300 meters up in the sky, said to him, don't look at the line that connects you to the boat. He was being pulled by a boat, but 300 meters up in the sky, and the monitor was behind him. He said, don't look at the line. Just look straight ahead or around you or whatever. And immediately when I heard this, after and I had come back and I heard this, I thought, that's it. That right there is all this teaching, what we talk about, no reference points, the relative and the absolute, and the letting go, taking the leap from the 100-foot pole, all of these different images, stories, anecdotes, maxims, all of these things that we say, it comes down to that. That if you look at the line that's connecting, and actually my husband did do this, he looked to see what the monitor was telling him, and he did, he looked at the line and he could see it going down to this tiny little boat that was about this big, which was immediate cause of anxiety. Whereas if he did not, if he just looked at the sky or the sea, it just was there. No anxiety. The anxiety came from focusing on the fixed point and attaching to that. So this is why we have trouble when we talk about letting go. You know, I talked about starting the sesshin. It's because I'm still focusing on the line that's attaching me to the boat. Whereas if I don't, if I have no reference point of how it should be, what I should say, how we should do things, how we should not do things, how people are doing, whatever, it's fine. There's no problem. It's just like looking at the sky, just being there. Um, Now, I did not do the parapente. I had no desire to go flying 300 meters up. And yet, at every moment, I can have that experience. We all can have that experience. Looking at the ocean is also a good example of that. The ocean, it's when we look out at the horizon, it looks immense. Or on the ferry, I'm crossing the Mediterranean on the ferry, and there's no land around. It's immense. It looks huge, immense. And that can also be cause for anxiety. There are people who really don't like boats being in the middle. Suddenly this feeling of emptiness, being in the middle of nowhere. There's some anxiety about whether the sea will be rough or not, and therefore will I be sick or not? Will the boat be tossed and turned? Will I actually make it? I'm giving myself over to this enormous force, which is the ocean, which is uncontrollable. We can't control it. And if I fix to the land or being stable or even the contours of seeing the land disappear as I'm going off, or the opposite, being on land and watching the boat in Bastia, watching the boat, the ferries leaving the port and disappearing into the night, then there's some sort of, there can be anxiety about it. Or maybe not even anxiety, but fear or displeasure, discomfort, leaving the land, wanting things to be as they are. But if I just go with the sea and go with its movement, no problem. And the same is true of every moment. We have no idea what...
I have an idea for you. Yes,
but we don't know what he would do with it if he took it, although we have some notions of it. There's also the glass of water that could be of interest. But we just let it be and we react according to the situation. So he comes. We become attentive to what, and we realize that if he takes a glass of water, it would not be good for him. He might break it. If he takes this, he might break it. We react according to the situation without having a fixed idea of what he should or should not do, or what I should or should not do, or what should take place at this moment. It involves being attentive, however, right? That's where awareness comes in. And fluidity. And reacting to the situation according to what is here, right? The environment. In the car on the way here, we were talking about Bernie Glassman. And I said he was the... Was the microphone here? Does it still recording if I'm carrying it? I said I was so inspired by Bernie Glassman's, what I would say, his realization and his manifestation of that, because that's what he does so vividly.
So?
Vividly. He, in whatever situation, he reacts according to the needs. He created an entire network of social services in a community that needed it, and it grew out of just reacting to what the needs of the community were. He didn't go to that community and say, I think we should do something here. That's the community he found himself in, and because, as Joel was telling the story, because he knows it, he translated the book, so he knows it quite well, as he needed people to work in order to help him, his group make pastries. And they needed to make pastries, they had a bakery, so that they could support themselves as practitioners. And they chose that business because there was a need for it, there was a market for it. In order to help them make the pastries, they needed some other people to work, so they had people in the community come and work. But then they discovered, as Joel was saying, these people had other needs. Some of them were homeless. Some of them were sick. Some of them needed education. Some of them were single mothers and had children and therefore could not work unless they had childcare. So they created housing for people. They created daycare centers for the working mothers. They created hospices to treat the people who had AIDS. Any number of social services that grew out of the needs of the community. And then began to, the people who had been helped began working in the daycare center or in the hospice. They trained as caregivers in different capacities. And all of this grew out of just the organic needs of the situation. This is what happens in every moment in our lives. But we don't experience it that way. We don't see it that way. We all came into this room and sat down as it was. We didn't come into this room and think, oh, this room should be different. This doesn't look like the room I was sitting in last month in the retreat, or this doesn't look like the room I was sitting in Portugal, so I can't sit here. No. I sit according to what I have here. We use the cushions that we have here. We use the light from the windows as it arrives here. When the sun sets, we turn on the lights. It's all very organic, the way that we function. However, we don't always experience it like that, and we try to make it different. We could have a lot of anxiety about wanting this room to look different, wanting it to be different, wanting the cushions to be different. I don't like this cushion, I want a different cushion. I don't like those curtains, I want different curtains. Any number of things we would like to change about the room. I want the door closed, I want the door open. I want silence, I don't want silence. I want the cats here but not the dogs. Any number of things. But essentially this practice, the very basic element of this practice is to be, to experience what is before we use all of those measurements and judgments and reference points. Before we look at the line connecting us to the little tiny boat, what is our experience of this moment? What is this? We enter this room free of judgment and just experience it. Then, very quickly, we will have judgments or preferences, and it might not even, they might not last more than a second. And it might not even be to do with the room, it may be to do with the person sitting next to us. Or to the time of day. Any number of things that we immediately seize upon and want to hold, change, reject. We want him to do something different. And then he goes back to his mother. actually probably functions much more freely than the rest of us here for the moment. But his preferences are already being established.
It's very clear.
Yes. And we can see when he's doing something that his mother doesn't want him to do and she pulls him back, he's not happy about it. Which is natural. He's learning about the world. And he's learning about his desires and what he wants and doesn't want and how he has to deal with that. And we all have to do that. The problem is when we stick to one story, when we stick to one version of reality and play that over and over and over again, then we miss all the other stories and all the other versions and all the other aspects. He's trying it all. He's tasting it all. And he made a discovery of what happens when he takes that off and it drops. We already all knew that, or we thought we did. And we probably had ideas about he shouldn't take that off, or, oh no, when it comes off it will make a loud noise, or it will fall on his fingers, or if he tastes it in his mouth it's full of mikrob or something and it will make him sick, or all kinds of things. He doesn't know that. And he's happy about it. So can we... The trick is that, okay, we are connected, you know, we're flying up here in the air 300 meters up, and we are connected to this little tiny boat. And we are dependent on the wind. And if we did fall, we would hurt ourselves. If that did fall on his fingers, it would hurt him, right? So how do we then function? How do we step into the moment knowing all of that and yet not being limited by it? So flying up there 300 meters, knowing that you're connected to by this flimsy little string that could break at any moment, to this boat down there that looks tiny, what do you do? To be fixed in one or the other, to deny that we are connected, to deny that we are limited, to deny that things change. Prevents us from experiencing things as they are. To be fixed to all of those aspects and deny that we are limitless is also to miss one aspect of reality. So what do we do? What we've all come here to do is just to sit here. So we all come and we sit together. And we all have our reasons. Everyone has their reason for coming here. And yet, on some level, it has nothing to do with any of those reasons. Any explanation we can give isn't really it. Any definition is not really it. Can we experience it before all of those explanations, definitions of why we came, what we would prefer to happen, where we would like to go while we're here? I read recently that the word refuge, we use when we talk about jukai, talk about receiving the precepts, another word that we use is taking refuge. Taking refuge in the three treasures. The Buddha treasure, the Dharma treasure, the Sangha treasure. And the word refuge in Latin is direct, a literal translation would be to fly back.
Well, I thought so.
Yeah. I think that's what I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And all that, and that's what our practice is about, in fact. Flying back home. We're already here. We take this plunge, we start this retreat, we go into it, we fly up 300 meters, whatever we do. But we're already here. And in fact, the Buddha, in all of his teachings, in some schools he is said to have had different phases in his teachings. And in his ultimate, when he was talking about the Lotus Sutra late in his teachings, when he was giving what we call the Lotus Sutra talks, he said, all of the stages and all of the process that I've been telling you about, it's all an illusion. There's nowhere to go. You're already here. So all these years I've been talking about this and I've been trying to attain something, trying to become awakened, trying to become a Buddha, as we say. But in fact, it's all illusion. You're already here. This is what I say all the time. You've heard me say that many times. There's nothing to get, nowhere to go, no one to become. You're all here. You are it. All of these things. And yet, we still need something. We still need techniques. We still need to practice. This was Dogen's challenge. If we are already it, why do we practice? And the image that sometimes is given is of a man whose house is burning and his children are inside playing a game, and no matter what he says to them, trying to get them to come out, he's telling them the house is burning, they have to get out, and they don't pay any attention, they won't stop playing the game. So he devises a different technique for each child, according to the child's likes, dislikes, how old the child is. He tells him that if he comes out, he will give him, I forget what the different things are, symbolic things, you know, he will give him a white horse or a black cow or a brown rabbit or something, according to the child's position. And each child reacts to what the father has offered. Because the father knows the child and knows where the child is and what his likes and dislikes are. And in that way, he saves all the children. They all come out. Well, this is the same, this comes back to Bernie Glassman, what I said at the beginning. According to the circumstances, according to who we are, where we are, what we need, we teach. At some, like I said, today I will speak English. Maybe I won't tomorrow. I don't know. According to the number of people we are, the cooks make that amount of food. They don't make enough food for 100 people because there aren't 100 people here. And it's obvious, right? Well, every moment is that obvious. Each life is that obvious. Every breath is that obvious. We make it much more complicated and cloudy. But it's that obvious. The cook calculates how many people there are and then cuts up that amount of carrots. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. It's not an exact science. The cook cooks the amount of rice for the amount of people. And that's what we do. We can do in every moment. I'm not saying we necessarily do. And with experience, we become more skillful at it. The more we sit, the more we allow things to arise, the more comfortable we are with letting things arise. A sailor who has sailed across the Mediterranean many times is probably more at ease with it than someone who is crossing it for the first time. Sailor knows different possibilities. He's comfortable with his abilities to navigate. He knows that he has looked at the weather and the state of the ocean and the winds, and he knows how to then navigate. He knows he can't control it. He knows always circumstances will arise that he can't control. Sometimes the carrots burn. He can't control it. Like, we don't know what Jan will do. We don't know what any of us will do in the next moment. We don't know what we're doing in this moment. We think we do, but we don't. The possibilities are endless in every moment. And as long as I'm fixed on that line that connects to the small boat, I will miss most of the possibilities. If Alain, my husband, had spent his time staring at the little boat, he would have missed the coastline and the view of the mountains, the view of the sea, the feel of the wind on his face. I don't know what all of his experiences were. He said at one point when they were turning in the wind, the monitor later told him that they had been going 80 kilometers an hour, that's very fast to be sitting in this little, held by this little harness on a parachute above the ocean. But that he didn't feel like 80 miles per hour because the feeling of that is relative. He was just there and there was wind. He couldn't possibly measure it. And in fact, we can't measure anything. Any measurement is approximative and relative. If we fix ourselves to those measurements, then we miss the limitlessness of it, what is immeasurable. The depths of the moment are unfathomable. The width of the moment is immeasurable, boundless. As is our being. Each being is boundless. And that's what we are sitting here doing. We're tasting boundlessness. It doesn't feel like that today. It doesn't feel like that on the first day. Usually. Or it might. It might sit down in that first period and you think, yeah. Or you might think, oh no. Sitting here all week. or you might not think any of that. You might just be feeling your knees. We just don't know. As I put on my blog, when I was in Portugal, I was giving the instructions at the beginning, and this woman said, she was there for the first time. I was very surprised. She had never done any sitting before, nothing. She saw on the internet that there was this retreat, and she came. And I showed her and some other people how to sit, and then she said yes, she had no experience, but that she had told herself, she didn't hesitate coming because she said, if I don't like it, I can leave. And I said, that's true. That's true. Fine. That was the first night, first day. She was there and she asked a question during the talk, if there were any other techniques. I had given her the technique to count the breathing. And she asked if there were other techniques because she didn't really like that technique. And I said, yeah, there are as many techniques as there are people. There's innumerable techniques. And there is really only one technique, and it's the best technique, the technique that you have at this very moment, and that I gave you. And that if you start switching from technique to technique, then you really don't do any technique. And I told the story about how when I had first done the breathing, counting the breathing practice, and what had happened to me, I didn't like it. But I was on a 3-day retreat, which was not in this lineage, it was in a different lineage, and there were no interviews, no talks, nothing. It was just sitting there staring at the wall. And I happened to be sitting in front of a window. I was lucky. I didn't have just the wall. And after the first day, I was so bored. This is just horrible. How am I going to last 3 days sitting here? And I was uncomfortable. I had never done any sitting like that before, and the cushions were bad. And I really didn't like it. And I was so bored. And so I thought, well, you know, the only thing I know to do, the only thing anyone has ever told me, is count my breath. So either I'm going to sit here and be bored and suffer, and my knees are killing me, and I have to just sit here and look at the window, or I try counting my breath and see what happens. And so I did. Started counting my breath, and after the next day, I can't even tell you what happened, but something happened that changed everything, and I was no longer bored. Everything was breathing. Everything was breath. The hills were, I was looking out because the hills were breathing. At the end of the retreat, the teacher asked, the Japanese teacher, he asked everyone to say something. Just one thing, whatever had happened or meant, what the retreat meant for them or something. And when it came to me, I said, the only thing I can say is, I'm just breathing. And he said, is it you breathing or the universe breathing? And I didn't know he would ask me that question. I had no idea. There was no mind suddenly, and I said, it's the same thing. And it was, and it is. I would not have had that experience of the oneness of the limitless, of taking my eye off the string, had I not sat there and just did the technique, just counted my breath. And I told the story to the woman when she asked the question in our talk. Okay? This was the first day. Second morning, we were all getting ready to sit down for breakfast. We didn't do a traditional orioki, we did an improvised orioki. And I looked out the window and I saw her going up the path towards the parking lot, leaving. The woman. And I had a sense of regret that I hadn't said to her that the practice is not about liking or disliking or coming and going, but just about sitting, experiencing beyond the likes and the dislikes. I had this regret that I hadn't said that to her, but then very quickly I realized I hadn't said it to her because she couldn't hear it. So it was sort of like the man trying to get his children to come out when they didn't understand the meaning of the house burning down. So there was no point in him in saying that. And I hadn't said that to her because she wouldn't hear it. Or in that moment, I trust that in that moment what I said to her was what needed to be said. And what I didn't say didn't need to be said in that moment. And that her going off on the path, on her path, on the second day without saying goodbye was her way, was fine, and was no cause for regret. From an absolute point of view, of course. From my relative personal preferences point of view, I had regrets. But from an absolute point of view, no regrets. Now the fact that you are all here, and that you have done this before, and that you keep coming back, means that you have experienced something beyond liking and disliking. Because there are moments when you like it here, and there are moments when you don't. And there are moments when you want to leave, and moments when you don't. There's a moment when you arrive, and there's a moment when you leave. But the fact that you sit here, minute after minute, hour after hour, day after day, is concrete evidence that something, you've tasted something beyond, and I say beyond not like something transcendental, something other than likes and dislikes. Here. I encourage you, however, to not be satisfied with that. To not be satisfied with, okay, yeah, there's something here that's beyond dislikes and likes. What is that? What is it? What is it that's limitless? What is it? What is it that includes everything? What is everything? What is the sky? What is that line? What is that boat? What is it? In the famous koan of "Is the flag moving or is it the wind moving?" when he says, "It's not the flag moving, it's not the wind moving, it's your mind moving," what is that? What does that mean? When we say that, there's always, whenever that story is told, there's always a moment of something, it's that gap moment. That moment before the wind starts moving again or the flag starts moving again. It's so short that we miss it. We can't identify it because it can't be identified. But there is something there in that moment when we say, it's not the wind moving, it's not the flag moving, it's your mind moving. Right then, we don't know what that is. And that's what I'm talking about. We don't know what that is. What is that that we don't know what it is? What is it that can't be identified? What do I experience when I don't fix on the line attached to the boat? just sitting here like this reminds me of the story, the koan of a, which I don't know if I've told here before, but a high government official comes to speak to a master. I'm sure I've told this before to you. And he's an official who is a practitioner as well. And he says to the teacher, who's very old and dying, what can I do after you die? What shall I do after you die in order to honor these teachings, in order to honor you? What shall I do? And the teacher says, build me a seamless tomb. And the teacher says, do you understand? And the guy says, the official says, no, I don't understand what that is. And the teacher, in the story it says, the teacher just sat and was silent for a while. And the teacher then says again, do you understand? And the official says, no, I don't. And the teacher says, okay, I have a successor. His name is, I forget what his name is. He's living in such and such a province. Go see him and ask him about it. So already now, the teacher has three times told him, given him an answer, build me a seamless tomb. He just sat and was silent for a while. And then he said, I have a successor. The official still didn't get it. And he went to see the successor. After the teacher had died. And the successor gave him a very elaborate, poetic explanation, which unfortunately I could go look it up. I have it, but I won't. In which he says something to the effect of there is a boat docked under the tree which doesn't give a shadow, and there is in the crystal palace there are no concepts, or something like this. It's poetic, very poetic thing. Which is another response to the question. These are all just answers to our question of what is it? The seamless tomb, a seamless tomb is a tomb that has no, I don't know how to say that in French. I know I've talked about this before. Yeah, because I've looked for this before. Sans couture. It would have no walls and no doors and no windows. It would just be one, right? Another way of saying that is just sitting in silence for a moment. Another way of saying that is, I have a successor, a living, breathing successor, who manifests it in another way. How do you build a seamless tomb? Be exactly who you are, with no seams. No limits. Live every moment fully.
Be a human being.
Exactly. because that's what you are. So, that's what it is today, and that's what it is every day, and that's what it is every moment. What is it to be a human being? What is it to be who you are? This is where this notion of refuge comes back. All we do is realize exactly who we are. It's all this practice is. Just to realize exactly who we are. And there's nothing transcendent, nothing nothing beyond, even though I say this is beyond likes and dislikes, it's not something beyond. Who we are is not something elsewhere. It's not someone other.
To realize, c'est réaliser dans le sens prendre conscience et dans le sens réaliser dans le sens faire, enfin, être.
Incarner.
Oui, d'accord. C'est dans les deux sens.
To realize it in the sense of, yes, to awaken to who we are, and then to manifest it. Because, in fact, the awakening is just a step. The actualization, the realizing of that, the realization, is, that's the job. Often what happens is we have some sort of awakening moment, and we think that's it. We think that we've arrived, and that that's the end. That's only the beginning. Then there's all the process of actualization, which is the hard part. And it used to be that in the Zen tradition, in ancient China, it started this way. Actually, the Buddha did this in his way, but someone would become, you know, would receive transmission or become recognized as a teacher, and then would disappear for 15 or 20 years. Just disappear into ordinary life. In order to grow into this being that they had realized. We've lost that, unfortunately. That was my greatest desire 5 years ago, was to just disappear. And I think my teacher, although she said to me, do whatever you want, her teacher had a different opinion. And I, you know, maybe it's my projection, but I had the impression that I could not do that. That I should not just disappear for 10 years, but that I should just be who I was at that moment. Which I couldn't be anything else, but of course I thought I should be something else, as we all do. None of us can be anyone other than who we are, but we think we should be someone else. And as Dogen says, why go wandering off on dusty trails when you are sitting on the throne right here? Why go looking elsewhere when you are already it and it's already here? This is where you need to look. Right where you are. And I often use the story of Joyce's Ulysses, which is a retelling of Homer's Odyssey, which, and they're both just stories of return, of returning home. We have to go out, we have to venture out, Otherwise, we would, if Jan didn't venture across the room to discover things, he would never be able to grow and become who he is. It sounds absurd. But we have to venture forth into the world in order to find out that we are already here.
So we need to differentiate ourselves from the world.
As a child, we need to make that step, yes. We have to separate from our mother. That's true. And that's a painful experience for both mother and child. That's true. And most of us carry some aspect of that throughout our lives, this difficulty of separation. And part of the my own personal difficulty of starting something new is related to that, of not wanting to set forth into something new. As we grow older, though, we learn to deal with that, and depending on our own personal background, our psychological makeup, any number of particular singular aspects of our being, we deal with that in different ways. Some people, like the woman who left the retreat, go off without saying goodbye, because then they don't really have to face the separation. They can pretend that it's not happening. And I know this one well, I've done that. End a relationship without really ending it. Just not calling the person back, ever. Some people cry at moments of separation. Other people don't. They don't want to feel it. Or they're more at ease with separation and they don't have this strong emotion tied with it. And these are big separations. There are little separations of finishing a book, of finishing the last drop of some wine we really liked, of changing, getting new glasses and having to give away the old ones, getting a new computer, getting your hair cut. My son is very attached to his hairstyle, and so then doesn't want any wind because he doesn't want his hair to move, and he wants it to look exactly the same every day. We all know this, right? Maybe it's not the hair, but it's something. This is all to do with impermanence, with letting go. Just being with what is, as it is. And if it's human, part of being a human being is resisting that, of wanting to remain a child, or wanting to always have the same life, or always not grow old, not grow sick, not die. But there's another aspect of being a human being which doesn't involve hanging on, which doesn't involve resisting. Human being. It's about being, not having. It's about being here now. And that also is an aspect of us. That's the true nature aspect of us, let's say. That is expressed in this ever-changing, non-fixed reality that we experienced as fixed beings. And part of that aspect of the relative aspect is time. So do we have, what time is it?
No.
Okay. So Caroline left very early for to make lunch. So Anyone questions or comments? I like that, actually. I like that silence. I also like questions or comments, but I like whatever comes up. Okay, I think that's enough words then for today.